is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is a very clear message that South Africa will never become a banana republic. This was an assurance from the Constitutional Court that nobody is above the law.
That's Denise Blom of the Opposition Congress of the People in South Africa welcoming the court decision to jail former President Jacob Zuma. Details coming up. Also, the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra group has been arrested, and the UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution extending the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Tigrayan troops have retaken the regional capital of Mekelle this week, prompting the Ethiopian government to declare an immediate ceasefire in the eight-month-long conflict. But U.S. lawmakers warned yesterday the ceasefire may be only temporary and will likely not prevent a looming famine impacting millions in the region. Celebrations in the street of Mekelle and Shire greeted the return of Tigrayan troops, but with both sides issuing veiled warnings, there are questions about the long-term outlook for peace, as U.S. Representative Gregory Meeks said yesterday.
I can only hope it opens the door to a peaceful resolution. However, I am hearing reports that the TPLF is threatening to enter Eritrea, which would be a clear and dangerous escalation in this conflict.
The Ethiopian army said today it could re-enter the seized Tigray regional capital of Mekelle within weeks if needed, and threatened a huge response if the Tigrayan forces reorganize. Tigray forces spokesman Getachew Reda told the Associated Press today, "They need to make sure that every inch of our territory is returned to us, the rightful owners." He said, "Ethiopian forces are still fighting to regain territory, and Eritrean forces still control a significant part of the region." With all sides alleging and denying abuses, Tigrayans accuse both Ethiopian and Eritrean troops of blocking food and aid. The U.S. Agency of International Development estimates up to 4.5 million of Tigray's 6 million residents require urgent food assistance, and nearly 900,000 people are already experiencing catastrophic conditions. U.S. Representative Michael McCaul cites the food crisis as a key issue.
War crimes, crimes against humanity, and acts of genocide have been carried out against the Tigrayan people. Last week, Prime Minister Abiy stated, quote, "There's no hunger in Tigray," unquote. The stunning denial of the catastrophic conditions on the ground in Tigray is appalling.
Sarah Charles of USAID told lawmakers that the humanitarian toll of sexual violence, including reported gang rapes, is incalculable.
Perpetrators have targeted the wives of priests, abused women in front of their families, and used brutal violence against women. As I've said publicly before, the severity of abuse is among the absolute worst I have seen in my nearly two decades of humanitarian work.
According to the Ethiopian government, the ceasefire is scheduled to last through the end of the planting season in late September. That presents a window of opportunity for the United States and the international community. The leader of the indigenous people of Biafra, IPOB, which the Nigerian government labels a terrorist organization, has been arrested and brought to court. Attorney General and Justice Minister Abubakar Malami says Ndamidi Kanu, the 53-year-old leader of the group that calls for the secession of a part of southeastern Nigeria, formerly known as Biafra, was detained on June 27th and brought back to Nigeria. He did not say from where. IPOB Group lawyer Ifania Ejofor has urged the government to guarantee Kanu's safety, saying he must be given a fair trial. According to Reuters, Kanu disappeared in 2017 while on bail. Since then, his whereabouts have been unclear, but he was very active, posting his thoughts on social media, which the government has called very incendiary. Information Minister Lai Mohammed cited Kanu's posts as a factor in the government's decision to suspend Twitter early this month. One of the most important legal rulings in South Africa's history. That's how opposition parties, political analysts, and civil society organizations are describing a decision made yesterday by the country's highest legislative body, the Constitutional Court. It found former President Jacob Zuma guilty of contempt of court for refusing to testify at the Commission of Inquiry into Corruption and sentenced him to 15 months in jail. The commission wanted Zuma to answer questions related to his alleged plunder of state enterprises of billions of dollars when he led South Africa between 2009 and 2018. Darren Taylor reports.
Jacob Zuma's 79-year-old stalwart of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC. He'd said he wouldn't respect a process he described as a political conspiracy against him. The man who ousted Zuma 3.5 years ago to become South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has vowed to rid the ANC of corrupt officials. Opposition party members, including the Congress of the People's Dennis Bloom, have welcomed the court's decision to jail Zuma.
Zuma has repeatedly said that he will not cooperate with the commission. He will rather go to jail. He got what he wanted. He's going to sit for 15 months. This is a very clear message that South Africa will never become a banana republic. This was an assurance from the Constitutional Court that nobody is above the law. The law of this country must be respected.
ANC spokesman Pule Mabe told the media in Johannesburg that the Constitutional Court order heralded a sad and difficult period for the party, but that Zuma had left it with no choice.
We have always said that institutions that are established to deepen constitutional democracy must be supported. We have said that the constitution of the republic is sacrosanct. It is important to drive forward the unity of our people because the very right...
Seven constitutional court judges agreed to imprison Zuma. Two disagreed. The Jacob Zuma Foundation says these dissenting views give the former president every right to doubt the integrity of the finding against him. Spokesman Mzwanele Manyi told VOA the judges who found Zuma guilty were emotional and eager to teach him a lesson.
If you've got competent judges, sober judges, that are saying this judgment is unconstitutional, how do you expect us as a foundation to say to our patron, he must accept the rule of law?
He says what's happening to Zuma, who he describes as one of Africa's greatest freedom fighters, is a travesty.
He must be shocked where he is that for all these years that he's been fighting for justice in this country, for all these years that he's been fighting for constitutional democracy, but we've got constitutional democracy that is dependent on opinions of judges as opposed to the law.
Zuma's relatives say he'll react in due course. But via Twitter, his daughter, Dudu, said she'd spoken with her father, who was in high spirits and having no fear. She said the Zuma family would escort the former president to prison in 5 days' time to begin his sentence. But not long after, Zuma's son, Edward, appeared on live TV to ally himself with his father's supporters, who insist he'll never spend a day in jail.
Whatever decisions law enforcement agencies decide upon, then they will have to pass by me, meaning I'll lay down my life for President Zuma. They are not going to take him to prison when I'm still alive. They will have to kill me first. I insist on that.
Manyi says Zuma's somewhere safe in South Africa at the moment and could soon speak to the nation. Many groups who've been battling for decades to have him declared a criminal say he had his chance to speak at the inquiry and he chose not to. So now he must head to prison with as little fuss as possible. But as they and the country well know, that's never been Jacob Zuma's style. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has commended the work of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum, LPDF, as its members meet in Geneva this week to finalize preparations for Libya to hold historic national elections on December 24th. The statement released today by Sullivan says the United States stands together with Libya as well as international partners in supporting the vote. Sullivan pointed out the presidential and parliamentary elections will enable Libyans to choose their leaders and re-establish their sovereignty after years of civil conflict and economic upheaval, saying it's imperative that Mali holds elections in February. The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution extending the UN peacekeeping mission in the crisis-wracked country. The UN, according to the Associated Press, also wants to increase the size of the force in light of the growing level of insecurity and physical violence against the civilian population in central Mali. Security Council members are urging all Malian stakeholders to resume and complete the political transition and hand over power to elected civilian authorities within the agreed-upon 18-month transition timeline. Fears are growing in Zimbabwe that power cuts may become permanent given that South Africa, which has been exporting energy to the country, is having its own electricity supply problems. From Bulawayo, Adigando has the story.
Since Monday, the country has reverted to recurrent blackouts or load shedding, which is affecting the delivery of essential services around the country. In a statement, the Minister of Energy and Power Development attributes the problem to what it describes as a surge in electricity imports from neighboring South Africa. Officials there say its own power grid is already overloaded. The ministry says that the surge has caused nationwide blackouts, which is affecting output at the Kariba hydropower plant and the coal-fired Wange facility. Power generation has, however, reportedly been restored at Kariba. Is the only one of the nation's five plants that is working as engineers battle to restore output at the Wange units. National consumption stands at 2,000 megawatts daily, with Kariba supplying about half of that amount. According to the statement, the country's energy demands are outstripping the amount of power being supplied. Zimbabwe does not produce enough of its own electricity and relies on imports from neighboring South Africa and Mozambique to meet the demand. Meanwhile, the city council is feeling the impact in the country's second largest city, Bulawayo. Nesisa Mpofu is the council's spokesperson.
The Nwema and Fenil pump stations last night lost 3 hours of pumping, and the Criterion Water Treatment Works still has no power since yesterday evening on Monday, the 28th of June, 2021. Residents are advised that this has negatively affected treatment of water, as well as pumping of both raw water and clear water.
Mpofu urges residents to adjust accordingly, adding that high-lying areas will experience low water pressure. Observers say that Bulawayo has been battling intermittent water supplies due to the failure of obsolete equipment, and that over a year ago, some likely died from contaminated water from the city's waterworks. They say that the situation is compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic, which requires good hygiene and running water. Meanwhile, economic analysts say the country's power deficit is a cause for national concern and that relying on energy imports is not sustainable. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko sees far-reaching repercussions for agriculture and mining.
Electricity is a driver of any economy. And once we have a serious shortage of electricity, it means the economy suffers. Sad part about the current blackout is that we've had a big talk about energy sufficiency by the government rolling out these licenses and these power generation projects. But all of them, they seem to be as good as paper tigers. They remain in the papers and we've seen no development in it.
Shoko and other analysts say that relying on Kariba and Wange is no longer reasonable given the country's growing energy demands. They are calling for a comprehensive strategy that reduces reliance on energy imports from its neighbors. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The UN Refugee Agency and its partners are racing against time and nature to repair and reinforce shelters damaged by storms in Sudan's eastern refugee settlement of Rakuba and Tundaiba, where more than 16,000 Ethiopians are camped. UNHCR spokesperson Boris Chesirikov said that 4,000 out of 10,000 individual family tents have been blown away and emergency latrines have been destroyed by strong winds, heavy rain, and hail. The UN and NGO partners are asking the U.S. for additional funding to carry out infrastructure improvements to the camps, including construction of more durable, transitional shelters to meet the basic needs of the refugees until the end of the year. Botswana, grappling with rising sexual offenses, is amending its laws to ensure tougher penalties for offenders. Those found guilty could face life in prison. From Habrone, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
The Minister of Defence, Justice and Security has announced in the Government Gazette that laws will be amended in July during the next sitting of Parliament. The notice indicates that sentences for sex offenders will be increased from a minimum of 10 years to 20 years behind bars. Perpetrators can be sentenced to life in prison as the Southern African country tries to stem the growing number of offences. Botswana has documented the incidence of such crimes with additional study which indicates that one in every three women had experienced abuse. In 2020, government statistics indicated a woman was raped every 4 hours. Gender activists like Desmond Lunga of Men and Boys for Gender Equality welcome the introduction of stiffer penalties. He, however, says the success of the new measures will depend on how well the laws are implemented.
I think what we need as a community now, as people in Botswana, is to see action. You know, we've had a lot of policies being developed, but we haven't been able to implement those policies that have been developed. So I think for us, it's more action.
Minister of Gender Affairs Anna Mukheti says while new initiatives have been introduced to deal with sexual offences, more remains to be done.
Notwithstanding the progress we have made in addressing GBV, there are still challenges that require all of us as a nation to join efforts in addressing them. Let me therefore make this plea to all citizens of this country that we should with one voice condemn GBV in all its forms and manifestations.
Among other measures to curb sexual offences, President Mokgweetsi Masisi announced the introduction of a sex offenders registry. The government has also set up an interministerial committee to address the problem while establishing gender-based violence units at local police stations. Additionally, there are now special courts which handle cases of gender-based violence. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Environmentalists are warning that the demand for charcoal in Somalia is fueling desertification and drought. Mohamed Kayi reports from Mogadishu.
The United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification, known as UNCCD, says an estimated 8.2 million trees were cut down for charcoal in Somalia between 2011 and 2017. Increasing land degradation, food insecurity, and vulnerability to flooding and drought. Dr. Abdullahi Elmi Mohamed, an expert in the field of environment, water, and climate change, says several parts of the country are experiencing climate-related shocks. due to the unprecedented deforestation rate in the past 3 decades.
In many parts of the Hiran region and in the Shabelle, middle Shabelle region, that is the places where several times we have seen a major flooding because of the low capacity of the river channel to carry a large amount of water, and that has clear correlation with the number of trees, because when the trees is cut, then it will be easy to erode the soil, which ends up into the river. So all these connections can be explained that the people has cut down a large number of trees, which could sustain the life of the rural people and their animals.
United Nations Security Council Resolution 2036, adopted in 2012, imposed a ban on the export of charcoal from Somalia. Although significant amounts of the charcoal still find their way to the Gulf states, the relative peace and stability experienced in Somalia and the lifestyle changes are forcing some Somali families, mainly diaspora returnees, to abandon the use of charcoal and firewood.
Previously, people used to use a lot of charcoal in the city, but as times have passed and people have resorted into using gas because of security has improved and there's availability of gas everywhere in town, so it's much easier to use the gas than to use the charcoal. Because the gas is faster and there's no smoke. Because of that, the environment is safe and no more trees are cut.
UNCCD says countries across the globe are expected to recover 1 billion hectares of land by 2030. The UN Programme's Executive Secretary Ibrahim Thiaw says his organization helps promote sustainable land management to protect the climate from overuse of land that results in drought. A spokesperson for Somali Prime Minister Mohamed Ibrahim Maalimu reiterated that cutting down trees for commercial purpose in the country is illegal and urged citizens to preserve the remaining forest cover. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.
African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.